submit enrollment materials to Gina current quarter, what we saw, all the different have come across, you know, pretty swift market movements to the downside and more recently upside. So some of the data and materials as I work through these decks is somewhat moot at this point. So I'm around a little bit, but I'll do my best to try to speak to what we're seeing, what's been happening, you know, more recently, and how that's been and impacting our outlook and decision making. So with all that said, as usual, let me skip ahead a little bit here. We'll get market environment. As always, just a quick discussion of the economic and capital markets perspective from Q1, provide a little context for how, why the funds performed the way they did. So starting at a high level for the economy, as always, we did note, it's a little bigger, the U.S. economy, as I'm sure you all well know, did contract in Q1 based on the first estimate that came out a couple of weeks ago at an annualized pace of -0.3%. Now that was a bit below economists' expectations. They had expected a positive print of about 0.3-0.4%. Now that said, it's hard to make much of this data because of the distortions when you peel back the layers a little bit. So for instance, what we did see is net exports actually detract about 4.8 percentage points from this headline number as a lot of firms attempted to front run the tariff announcements in early April. So in essence, net exports filters in their calculation what's what we export abroad, less what we import here at home. And usually that's not a big contributor or detractor because the US is a relatively closed economy, meaning that trade makes up a relatively small portion of our economy compared to many other countries abroad. But that said, you can see the massive impact on the headline number here. You know, what we do know is that consumer spending, as we know down below here, did decelerate from Q4, but did come in a little better than economists forecast. And speaking about forecasts, we shift gears and look at the top right chart here. The fully colored in bars are the actual data, quarterly data. Going back over the past few years, the orange bar is the year-over-year GDP growth. And then the striped ones are economists' estimates. So what's relevant about these are they're quite a bit lower than the data we shared a few months ago. Most of these ranged in the kind of 2-2.25% range. And now they're about 0.5% to 1%. But that said, as we sit here this morning, they might have been revised higher. Again, it's important to note that these are end of Q1 data and a much different environment back then and even early April compared to where we sit this morning. Now, much of this was revised down, as again, I'm sure you all well know, due to uncertainty as it relates from a policy perspective, largely as it relates to tariffs, which we'll talk more about later on, and the general impact they may have on particularly business spending and consumer spending. And we see some of the impact, at least from a sentiment perspective, down here below, where we're showing consumer confidence in purple, CEO confidence in blue here, and then their own respective averages in the same dotted colored lines. And what's notable is a little bit of drop off and fairly steep for CEO confidence in Q1. Again, given that policy uncertainty, you know, from a CEO perspective, you know, how do you decide, you know, how much to spend, reinvest in your business, how many people to hire if you don't know where your input costs are going to be over the next 3, 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. Now, some of that uncertainty has been alleviated, obviously, given the pause, the recent announcements that we saw in Geneva over the weekend with China. I think it's important to remember at this stage, there's really no frameworks in place outside of potentially the UK. You know, a lot of it's been discussion and then the pausing of those tariffs announced on April 2nd. So we're not necessarily at the end game here. So the worst case scenario, hopefully it's been kind of taken off the table, and that's what's driven market higher over the past, say, 3, 4, 5 weeks, as we'll see more later on in the April data and the second deck that I'll go through later in the meeting. The other interesting thing from an economic perspective, when we think about what's going on, particularly from the dynamics of the Fed, is they're in some tension right now. You know, when we think about the Fed perspective, clearly the economy has decelerated based on the data, you know, not the distortions notwithstanding. At the same time, inflation expectations have ticked up a little bit here from a consumer perspective. They've ticked up within the market. We note that it's called the inflation swap market is generally used as a predictor of what the market thinks inflation is going to do here in the short term, ended at a two-year high for one-year inflation expectations over the next year, you know, starting April 1st. But at the same time, with the economy decelerating again, a little bit of a tension in the Fed's mandate of stable prices and full employment. And the Fed has been relatively consistent since the end of last year with their base case for this year, meaning that they were thinking base case of around two cuts this year. The timing of those cuts has likely shifted around a bit, but they just gave us the base case for the full calendar year. But the market itself has been all over the place. You know, we came into the year, the market was kind of in sync with those two cuts. We ended the Q1, as we note here, the market was pricing in three full rate cuts, and you know, at the depths in April, it was up to five rate cuts, and now it's all the way back down to two. So the market's been somewhat manic around the pricing of those cuts, largely depending on the data and the news flow. And we'll see that later on within fixed income returns. They were very good in Q1 as the market was pricing in more and more cuts, kind of dragging down yields across the yield curve, putting up pressure on bond prices. That continued to some degree in April, but now here in May, as again, sort of the worst case scenario has been taken off the table, the data and news flow have turned more positive, those rate cuts have come all the way back down to two, essentially. So that's, you know, in turn put more upward pressure on the yield curve and brought down some fixed income returns for the month of May. But again, we'll get into that data, the later data shortly, but we can skip ahead and look at the Q1 data from a market perspective here on page 13. And at a high level, what was interesting is that, at least in Q1, it was basically the polar opposite of Q4, meaning that in Q4, what we saw across these major asset classes was U.S. equities posted a very marginal gain, whereas nearly everything else was negative. So, as you can see here, pretty much the polar opposite, where U.S. equities were comfortably in the red, but everything else was decently positive, sometimes strongly so in the case of developed non-U.S. equities. So we did see developed non-U.S. And emerging markets outperform the U.S. quite handily. A couple things probably at play there. Number one, the U.S. dollar did weaken during the quarter, particularly against developed non-U.S. currencies. So that was a tailwind for U.S.-based investors in those markets. And then a general shift around what we're calling the fiscal narrative. So what I mean by that is over the past few years, the U.S. has run a pretty expansionary fiscal policy, despite the fact that it's peacetime and there was no recession. When we compare that environment relative to history, we're at historic deficit levels, which in turn has supported the economy and supported corporate profits, whereas outside the U.S., things were much less stimulative. But given you know, all the conversations and the rhetoric in Q1 around tariffs and the like, what we saw is essentially outside the U.S., particularly Europe and particularly Germany, what we talk about here a little bit, was a shift to a potentially more stimulative fiscal outlook. So Germany actually passed a 500 billion euro package as it related to defense and infrastructure. So again, we think about, you know, who's stimulating from a fiscal perspective. At the margin, it's kind of shifting from U.S. to non-U.S., and that narrative, we'd argue, was at least partly at play to the relative outperformance we saw outside the U.S. compared to U.S. markets, and a couple other things that I'll mention on the next page. U.S. bonds here you see up just a shade under 3%, so given my comments earlier around the uncertainty, the market pricing in more and more Fed rate cuts that are pulling down interest rates and putting upward pressure on bond yields was quite helpful for investment-grade fixed income. Bank loans here, just a marginal return during the quarter, up about 0.6%. You know, certainly positive, but in an environment where the market was pricing in more and more Fed rate cuts, that was a little bit of a headwind to bank loans, as we've talked about it at previous meetings, given their floating rate characteristics. And then as far as some of the other asset classes we'll see later on, we see real estate was up just a shade under 1%, and then infrastructure was also up around 2.5%. So again, you know, pretty much everything posting marginal or solid gains outside U.S. equities. So having a diversified portfolio within both funds was quite helpful. Then just a couple other quick comments on U.S. markets before I shift gears here. And again, as you peel back the layers, it was very different than Q4. So So again, in Q4, there was a marginal gain in U.S. equities, but most sectors, I think it was 7 of 11, were negative during the quarter. And the market posted that marginal gain because the largest sectors comprised of the largest stocks did the best, right? So as we talked about, you know, repeatedly at previous meetings, you know, those mega cap growth AI tech related names within the U.S. did very well in Q4, driving the market up, but it was the opposite in Q1. So most sectors, as evidenced by these lighter bars, were actually positive, but the market was down comfortably because those largest sectors, right, your communication services, where you find your Metas, your Alphabets, your consumer discretionary, where you find your Teslas, your Amazons, or information technology, where you find your Apples, your Microsofts, et cetera, were down notably, and that dragged down the bond market. A couple reasons likely behind that. Number one, there was news that really came out late last year, but only gained prominence in later January around, as we note here, the emergence of a lower cost Chinese developed AI model. Really, some investors thought is a threat to the dominance of US AI leaders in the space. So again, your Microsofts, your NVIDIAs, et cetera, and the market share that they've been really dominating in that space over the past couple of years. And then secondly, as it related to the trade rhetoric, if we think about those larger companies, they, as a proportion of their sales derived from outside the US, it's much higher than other parts of the market. So if you look at this bottom axis here, think about this as smaller companies to the largest companies as you work your way from left to right. So those largest companies derive almost half their sales from outside the US. So to the extent you'd be selling goods abroad, like or importing goods back home, you know, your Apples, your NVIDIAs would have a big impact. But for those that are more services oriented, like your Microsofts, your Googles, et cetera, you know, there could be some dynamic for, say, nationalistic type tendencies where consumers and businesses abroad are essentially mad about what's going on and to the extent possible, you know, buy locally, right? To the extent they can from other businesses that provide similar services or similar products. Now, there aren't many of those abroad, but that was a level of concern, again, given the changing geopolitical dynamics. Would there be some nationalism or nationalistic tendencies to shy away from U.S. firms? So again, that really the key driver, along with this dynamic of the largest stocks underperforming, which in turn was helpful for the fund, as we'll see here in a minute, because like we talked about in the past, we have exposure to those names, but we're underweight them, largely due to the fact that what we've seen over the past few years is that those stocks have been generally leading things to the upside, but when we do see downdrafts, whether it be brief but sharp, like we saw more recently, or in 24 and 23, or more protracted drawdown in 2022, they've led things to the downside, coupled with the fact that their valuations remain, we'd argue, fairly extended. And when the market turns down, usually what's most expensive tends to get hit the hardest. With all that said, and I do want to note, I cannot see anybody. So if somebody has a question or comment, please feel free to just interrupt me or throw things out there, and I'll be mindful to pause as we continue to move through the materials. So if we get into the pension here, again, we'll cover the pension in more detail and the OPEB fairly quickly because the investments mirror each other. But what we saw at the market value at the end of March was $172.1 billion. That investment chained down $250,000-ish, given the allocation to U.S. equities within the fund more than offset the gains that we had in the rest of the portfolio. And that translated into a return of down 20 basis points. That was ahead of the policy index benchmark of down 60. And I'll talk more about the drivers of that in just a minute. But most importantly, from a fiscal year perspective, where we're at through the end of March, and I'll give you an update later on when we look at the performance updates in April, we're about 4.4% as of March, so 75% of the way through the fiscal year. So what drove this outperformance for the fund relative to the policy, really a couple things, and they're interrelated, is what we're calling equity structure here, meaning that the underlying investments, particularly in the global equity space, are essentially structurally underweight those large mega cap US stocks. So in other words, being underweight those names from how the pieces fit together was helpful. right? So sometimes avoiding the losers, if you will, is just as important as picking the winners. And I recognize they're not mutually exclusive, but that was helpful. And in turn, that led most active equity managers to outperform their respective benchmark. And then a little bit of a headwind on the negative side was, even though emerging markets posted gains, they underperformed non-US equities, and we have just an ever so small overweight to emerging markets based on valuations compared to developed non-US equities. So having more money in an area, even though it made money, underperformed slightly, was a little bit of a headwind. And then looking ahead, I just want to bring you up to date here. Real estate continues to wind down. As we sit here this morning, it's around 2.5% of both funds, so hopefully that will be fully exhausted and liquidated later this year, if not early 2026. So with that said, we'll get into the data. Again, we'll keep things pretty high level, but get into a little bit of the granularity on the underlying investments. So up top, you see where we began the calendar year and how we ended up at the end of the quarter. You know, looking at the net cash flow and the net investment change left us lower by about 143 grand. We'll talk more about the performance here in just a minute when we look at it in a peer perspective, including the quarter and short, intermediate, and longer term time horizons. But always worth mentioning that when you look at this bottom table, you see the permissible asset classes to the left here per the investment policy statement, their current allocations, and all of these are within the policy ranges, right? So in other words, we see yes and up down across the board here. We're within the respective permissible ranges per the committee and council approved investment policy statement. So we're in compliance at the end of the quarter, as we pretty much always are, absent some, you know, large cash flows.
Pat, can I chime in with a question?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, George Spindell. I am brand new to the committee, so forgive the rudimentary question. Is there an investment policy statement for the funds?
Yes, sir, there is.
Yep. How would I get that to review it?
Either I can send it to you, or Gina, I don't know if there's a link.
That's I have it. I thought I sent it, but maybe I didn't.
And you may have, Gina. You may have.
I'll go back. I think I did send it to the group, but
okay.
Or when you were appointed.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind. And then related to that, Pat, a minute ago you talked about winding down some real estate. I'm just curious, are those REITs or LPs or what?
So it's core real estate, so core commercial real estate. So it's an investment manager, Clarion, and their Lion Properties Fund. Essentially, they own and operate commercial property across the four major sectors. So think your office, apartments, industrial, retail, and then some other sectors like life sciences, hotels, things like that. So they own and operate these properties and run essentially a private investment fund. So it's not a mutual fund or a publicly traded security. And then the county's funds essentially own shares of that fund. And per a previous adjustment to the policy, this was implemented, I think, a little before COVID, and obviously things threw, we got thrown for a loop there. What we did was recommend, which the committee and the council approved, getting out of that essentially, and now we're in the process of getting the money back. So you can see here the allocation of that is just a shade under 3%. You know, as we sit here this morning, it's closer to 2.5%, and we're getting those proceeds back each quarter, but it's taking a little longer than typically would have, just given the underlying dynamics in the real estate market remaining a little challenged from an occupancy perspective.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So with that said, let me just highlight a couple other things here. There was some activity during the quarter. So to the left here, you see all the underlying individual investments. So here's the real estate fund we were speaking to earlier, and then JP Morgan, the infrastructure fund, which is a similar type of vehicle in that it's a private fund, but this fund, instead of real estate, it's infrastructure. So think JP Morgan here is owned and operates, you know, things like utilities, toll roads, seaports, airports, you know, various infrastructure assets as opposed to real estate assets. But with that said, we did make some marginal changes. So we trimmed equities kind of in the middle to latter half of February, because, you know, it's hard to remember, but the market was actually doing well in Q1 for pretty much the first half. So we took that opportunity to trim things a little bit. You can see that $1 million flowing back into fixed income down here. But then we also did make some changes within the equities that we think will make things a little bit more defensive here moving forward. So not necessarily changing the exposures with cross asset classes, but within them. So for instance, we added another manager here, WCM, that, you know, this operates in a similar space as Artisan, but takes a more quality focused approach, which we believe in historically has and will lead to more downside protection in the future. So you took about half of Artisan's allocation away and moved it to WCM. And then within international, we did liquidate this allocation to Harding Loevner. That was a focus on international small caps. Then moved it back to the broader index, which is not just small, but predominantly mid and large cap companies. So the former small caps tend to get hit pretty hard in economic uncertainty and when things turn down. So we essentially reduced the allocation to small and added it to the broader index there. Here you can see the money we got back from Clarion in Q1. We got back a similar amount in early April, as well as that continues to wind down. And then, as I mentioned earlier, some rebalancing. The other thing I want to note quickly, and we can see this on the update, is that we're holding a little north of $2 million in the money market fund. It's a little more than 2% of the overall fund, because we'll be coming up on essentially the reimbursement for the fiscal year. So Ms. Jennings usually sends me that number for the pension and the OPEB, you know, in June, as we look to reimburse. And essentially, we, you know, took some proceeds when things were going well to build up that bucket to essentially mitigate the risk of having to sell something at a bad time. In other words, when markets turn down. So despite what happens, maybe over the next 4 or 5 weeks, based on what the number is, again, it was 2 million last year, so hopefully it's in line with that again. We essentially have that liquidity and don't run the risk of over the next 5-6 weeks have to sell something to meet those needs. So with that said, let's take a look at the returns in a little bit more detail here. So this page is, as most of you all know, is just a peer page. So we're showing how the pension's doing to other public defined benefit plans within the investment metrics universe, which is the third party platform that we use to generate these reports. So the chart here is just a reflection of these underlying data. So I tend to focus more on this. It's a little bit clearer, but you can see the respective universe sizes in each of these periods. So they're, you know, decently large, between 450, 550 to draw some conclusions. And the key data for the pension and the policy index are here as you work away from left to right. And then the rankings are in parentheses. So that negative 0.2 for the quarter was marginally better than the median, leaving us in the 41st percentile. So in other words, lower numbers in parentheses are better and vice versa. And as you work away from left to right, you're kind of oscillating between kind of top decile in the 3 year and top third. So the fund has done, you know, I would argue fairly well compared to peers. But I think what's, you know, just as it, maybe even a little more important these days, as I skip ahead to some similar analysis, now that we're kind of in this negative cash flow profile, you know, downside protection is, you know, very important, because we have these annual liquidity needs. The worst thing that can happen is essentially having to sell at the wrong time. In other words, after markets have declined to meet those needs, because once you sell an asset, essentially you permanently impair it. In other words, it's not allowed to recover. And when you do that after it's declined, that's kind of a worst case scenario. So same analysis, but the returns, some of the intermediate longer term ones to the right here, but then we're showing the Sharpe ratios to the left, which are essentially risk-adjusted returns. And for these dynamics, you can see, you know, pretty decent results relative to the peer group, kind of oscillating again between that top decile and top quintile here, an improvement from the just absolute return. So on a risk-adjusted basis, again, which is very important now that we're in a negative cash flow profile, given the strong funded status of the plan itself and the fact that, you know, it continues to incrementally mature over time is very important in our opinion. And then let's talk a little bit about the underlying investments here, and then briefly on the OPEB, just high level. So the total fund up top, you can see same data that we looked at on the you know, earlier peer page. Anytime you see another blue row, you see composite, it's just synonymous with asset class, and then a weighted average of the underlying investment. So total equity, weighted average of US, global, non-US. So you can see here's really where, you know, the performance or outperformance, excuse me, was driven at the total fund level, right? So if the total equities were 70 basis points ahead, you know, 60% of 70, 42-ish, so there it is. And again, much of that was driven in global that we'll see here shortly, but the U.S. outperformed incrementally. So what was interesting is that even though those mega large tech-related firms underperformed, large caps in general, commonly due to large cap value, actually incrementally outperformed the broad market. What was also helpful on a relative basis is that outside of large caps, within small and mid-cap stocks, a more defensive type of approach was helpful. So Eaton Vance, Atlantic Capital here, in other words, more defensive, kind of higher quality, small mid-cap growth type manager, providing some downside protection. And then Vanguard Small Cap Value attracts a different benchmark than most small cap value managers out there that track the Russell 2000 value. This also did better because it's more of a higher quality type benchmark. So the higher quality tilts were helpful in a tough environment. And then on the global side, as I referenced earlier, global equities were actually up a little more than 1.5% compared to the broad global equity market that was down 1.5%. And that was largely due to not just two of the three managers between Dodd & Cox, Artisan, and MFS, who were in the pension for the entire quarter, outperforming, but also how the pieces fit together. So in other words, Dodd & Cox is essentially, you know, a value stock manager, global value, Artisan, WCM, global growth. So essentially those two fit together, comprise the market. But then we have this additional allocation to MFS down here, more low volatility managers, so focusing on stocks that tend to have, say, lower highs, but also importantly, higher lows over time. And given their process and the pond that they essentially fish from, will be underweight those more mega cap, more volatile names. So not just the managers themselves relative to the benchmark, but again, how the pieces fit together, driving the outperformance in global equities. Non-US, kind of in line with the benchmark, not too much to speak of here, incrementally ahead, but again, more of an from an absolute return perspective, you know, being helpful for the total fund. And then as we shift gears to the real estate and infrastructure, again, we can see Clarion here up just a shade under 1% during the quarter. Obviously, the past 3 years post-pandemic has been difficult, to put it mildly. It's winding down. We're sub 5 million. And then we'll see in the April update that we're, you know, close to, I believe, 4.5 million as it continues to wind down. JP Morgan here, as I noted earlier, up just a shade under 2.5%, so it continues to post pretty strong, steady results, again, in the infrastructure space, unlike Clarion in the real estate space. Bank loans for Aristotle, again, more muted quarter, just up about 0.5%, a little behind the benchmark there. In Q1, again, not too much to speak of. And then as far as fixed income, you can see incrementally ahead. Wilmington Trust was largely in line with the prospective benchmark. So, you know, if you think about it as an accounting identity, if they were in line, but in aggregate things were ahead, it means the combination of Fidelity here and Lord Abbott in aggregate did a little better than Wilmington Trust here, driving that incremental outperformance. Let me pause quickly there for any questions or comments, and then we'll just do the OPEB quickly before moving on. So OPEB, again, we'll just look at things at a very high level. We'll look at all these, you know, the takeaways and all this are broadly the same as the pension. So we'll just look at the specific data here for the OPEB. You see the first quarter, we began at about $70.13 million. You see the net cash flows, net investment change left us about 114 grand lower than where we began. From a return perspective, from Q1 through 5 years, will pretty much be spot on, absent some rounding as the pension. When you look at the 10-year figures, just to remind some of you and let some of you know, in sort of year 6 to 10 here, the pension had an allocation to the state pool. So that's why you'll see differences in returns of the OPEB and the pension for that 10-year number, whereas for pretty much everything else, they're spot on one another. All the permissible asset classes within their respective ranges, again, so in compliance with the EIPS. And then from an activity perspective, you know, everything comparable to the pension in spirit. Obviously, the dollars are a little different. So you can see the trimming of U.S. equities up here. Again, the rebalancing back in the fixed, the changes within global and international, the returning of capital by class. So again, everything similar in spirit. Again, a decent cash position to have that, you know, ready for when the reimbursement comes and not put ourselves in the position that we'd have to sell something at the wrong time. And then finally, from a peer perspective too, again, it's comparable numbers in the pension as you work your way from left to right. Again, one thing to note, the 10 years a little bit better than the pension because of that lack of a state allocation again in year 6 to 10. But I won't go through the underlying investments again, they mirror those of the pension. So before we move on into the April updates, let me pause there once more, see if there are any questions or comments around the Q1 report.
This is Lance, can you hear me?
Yes, Lance, how are you?
I had a question, I'm good. On the rebalancing, really the chart you showed for the different investments, I was just curious on how you guys go about when to rebalance. For example, the Fidelity Fund you mentioned earlier back in February, took some profits at a good time before things pulled back. Is that a normal rebalance, or is there some trigger that you look at and say, hey, here's where we're going to take profits and move some to either bonds or the money market fund?
Yeah, it's both to some degree, Lance. So let me take a step back. So we have a committee that makes these decisions. So I'm not the sole, I want to be clear, I'm not making these decisions in a vacuum, that will look at everything on a weekly basis. Take into consideration where we think, you know, what markets have recently done, you know, the probabilities or the distributions of potential outcomes moving forward. So it's subjective to some degree from that perspective, but the committee makes those explicit decisions that from where to take the funds and where to rebalance. And admittedly, this time around in February, we largely thought that, or I'm sorry, let me back up, in a more quote-unquote normal environment, if you will, we might not have made this decision, but given the market had such a strong run, absent a couple hiccups over the previous calendar years, and given, in our opinion, which we can show later on in the market update deck, the market was getting incrementally more over and overvalued, we decided to just take some chips off the table. Now, as I said, it's kind of a bit of both. That was more subjective. We do have a more systematic rules in place that if we breach, we meaning the pension fund breaches 300 basis points over and underweight relative to targets, say in equities in aggregate or fixed income in aggregate, then it does essentially force a rebalancing. Now, not all the way back to targets, but forces an incremental rebalancing to try and take some of the emotion out of it, some of the behavioral issues out of it, and essentially force ourselves to, you know, sell high and buy low when those opportunities arise. So there is a subjective component to it, but when things get extreme, there's a systematic component to it to kind of reduce the probability of, again, having the behavioral issues, which are usually not helpful, be the overriding factor in decision making.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's do April quickly here before we wrap up with the last deck. So now we'll begin to weave in what's been happening more recently in markets. So we bottomed in, when we think about U.S. equity perspective, I think it was April 8th or April 9th, and then saw very dramatic reversals. I'm sure I'm not telling anybody anything they don't already know. And what was interesting, even though U.S. equities, as you see here in aggregate, were down slightly, the trends and the leadership that we saw in Q1 persisted as the markets continue to kind of plumb and make new lows. However, once things reversed with some of those news flow and then headlines and posts by the president, things dramatically reversed and that leadership totally shifted. So it was more of those mega cap tech names, some in the small mid cap space, more AI, crypto related, quantum computing related, again, more cyclical, volatile, speculative names that really ramped higher, and that's continued into May. So when we think about those dynamics, a little bit different of a market environment. So the total fund was up 0.3% for April, about 20 basis points behind the policy, or given what happened in equity markets and that reversal. Fiscal year to date at 4.8, as we sit here this morning, given markets continue to be strong in May, yesterday, excluding real estate, excluding infrastructure, where we don't have the data, got it about maybe 2.8% in May. So when you fiscal year to date, we're around probably 7.677. So we're in a decent position here today as we look to close out the fiscal year here in a month and a half or so. So a decent cushion there, which is good from an actuarial perspective. Now back to the quarter to date or the month. Again, equities were a little bit behind, pretty much given the dynamics I talked about within the U.S. And mostly in that sort of small and mid-cap space, we saw a big run-up in a lot of the names that did well in Q4 last year. Again, more kind of crypto, quantum computing, very speculative names that did quite well. And that was the headwind, right? You see our allocation of the S&P 500 index was pretty much in line with the market. But within the small and mid-cap space, even though we advanced it a little bit better, by and large, this area continued to underperform a little bit, which drove this at the U.S. equity level. But then from a global perspective, again, a decent performance, at least on a relative basis, from these names. And this wasn't necessarily because those largest stocks in the U.S. continued to underperform this time around. It was because these managers did a decent job relative to their own benchmarks. You see both Dodge and Cox and MFS posted nice relative gains or relative outperformance. And then Artisan and WCM and Aggregate were just a little bit behind during the quarter, or excuse me, during the month. And then finally for non-US here, some underperformance, this EM headwind continuing to be a little bit of a detractor here. You know, it's not huge within the portfolio, but it has been a little bit of a drawback or detractor, not just in April, but year to date as well, and really for the fiscal year. Real estate infrastructure, again, we don't have the data. Bank loans were up marginally, a little bit better than the benchmark there that was down slightly. And then fixed income as well, another decent month. However, May has been very different, up just a shade under 1%, kind of in line with the benchmark. And these data pretty much follow suit again for the OPEB, so I won't belabor it here. But for the OPEB, again, pretty much spot on. This number is just rounding by a couple basis points. So again, as we sit here, we're probably 7.6-ish on the OPEB as we have about 6 weeks left in the current fiscal year. And as we jump into the last deck, I'll pause once more. But my plan for that is really to talk more about what's been happening, more around the outlook and how things may unfold and what decisions we may make as we close out the fiscal year and head into fiscal 26. But before doing that, let me pause there, see if there are any comments or questions. Gina, I know this is a different agenda item. Is it good to just proceed here?
Yeah, you can move on to the market update.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, so I have to admit, I never sent a market update the Friday before a Thursday meeting and have some of it be irrelevant 3 business days later, given what happened in Geneva over the weekend and some of the market returns, particularly on Monday of this week. But that said, I'll probably skip some of this stuff again. It's not as relevant as it was just not even a week ago. But I do want to focus on some of the more higher level information and kind of weave it into, again, the potential outlook here and how it's impacting how we view the world and decision making as we continue through 2025. So these first couple pages largely probably reiterating things that we're all well aware of, right? And as we think about, what really drove the weakness, a lot of it was due to the fact that, a lot of new policies being talked about, potentially implemented, but the issue really was, twofold. Number one, some cross currents on their respective impacts as it relates to, say, economic growth, inflation, or the deficit, which meant that obviously the details, but particularly the sequencing of these, was going to matter a lot. So what's been largely the focus of the administration so far, and when you think about this impact of growth, it's just, consider it in the very short term, right? Tariffs, immigration, spending cuts, negative on the margin for growth. And as far as the details, largely coming out of the tariffs, everybody was surprised on April 2nd as far as the breadth, the magnitude, and the timing of that announcement. It was kind of the trigger for the pretty rapid decline we saw over the next or the subsequent week or so. At the same time, things that would have a more positive impact, like deregulation, not much talk of yet, the expiring tax cuts, the extension of those, and maybe new tax cuts at the margin here will be largely positive. Now, this is just coming into focus now. So this coupled with sort of a receding or more helpful news flow and data around tariffs been helpful for the markets over the past 5-6 weeks. But when we think about these dynamics, you know, again, something you're all, I'm sure, well aware of, but as we think about, you know, quantifying the impact to some degree, you know, the tariffs themselves led to a large spike in economic uncertainty. When we think about these dynamics, the economic uncertainty was the highest since it was during COVID, and again, this could prove problematic to the extent it impacts economic decisions, right? Again, consumers, businesses, does it induce this sort of level of paralysis, right? Which in turn would not be helpful for the economy. So not just that it spiked, but how long it would persist. And if we think about it persisting for a while, it would, you know, again, at the risk of stating the obvious, have a bigger impact on the economy. So this is a third party, I think, helpful illustration of, you know, when the economic policy uncertainty increases, if it's a temporary shot, think about these lines that are below zero, not so this is what GDP is going to be next quarter or the quarter after, but where we would be amid the shock relative to what otherwise would have been the case. In other words, absent the shock, right? So the temporary shock, permanent shock, you know, in first quarter or two, they're both temporary until one becomes more permanent. But this was the concern, right? That the uncertainty was going to remain elevated and it was going to impact the economy on a more protracted basis from a magnitude and time horizon perspective. But now the hope is that this is what's happening and this is what's folding, a more muted, less protracted shock, and we're going to essentially claw our way back to where we otherwise would have been absent this shock. But the key impact on markets isn't necessarily this in a vacuum. The impact is always, you know, how the data and news flow come in relative to expectations. So when we came into the year, what these bars show are the probability of a recession based on a Bloomberg consensus survey. We came into the year, it was relatively muted, right? So if we think about these dynamics, you know, going back a few years ago, when we headed into 22, things were relatively muted, right? Just meaning that the expectations are relatively optimistic, there's a higher bar to clear. And then as we all well remember, inflation started spiking, the Fed raised rates, and everybody became concerned over a recession. These odds spiked, equities got hit, but then where did we bottom? When the odds were the highest, right? Because then the pessimism set in, the bar was much lower to clear for the data and news flow. We had a really strong market over the past 2+ years, ended up in a more optimistic scenario, and then given all the announcements and the news flow and the data, incrementally increasing the odds of a recession largely has driven markets, or did drive markets down to the extent that they did, because number one, the impact that they would essentially have on essentially corporate fundamentals from an earnings perspective, and also the price investors are willing to pay for those earnings, right? So from a valuation perspective, and we'll talk more about those dynamics in a little bit. This page is largely irrelevant now as we sit here this morning. The U.S. markets are basically flat for the quarter. I think what's interesting is that, you know, non-U.S. markets have continued to outperform in April, up around 10.5% this year. Fixed income's largely the same as we sit here this morning, kind of around 2.5%. And the bank loans are up around 1.5%. So again, even though markets in the U.S. are roughly flat now, having that additional diversification, you know, proving helpful at a time where U.S. equities came under a bit of pressure. Now, what's interesting on this page is this is essentially the peak to trough drawdown we saw on the S&P at around 19%. And we have some pages on the next couple slides that provide some, you know, good historical context for this. So again, we finished around 19% peak to trough. Since 1940, these 6 episodes have at least a 10% drawdown at any time during the markets. 32 of those ended before we got to 20, and then we were claiming previous highs, right? So about 70% of the episodes essentially ended where we ended, right? At negative 19 in this 10 to 20% range, whereas 30% developed into something, you know, more sinister, if you will, you know, a bear market, which is lost 20% or more or greater. Now to think about, you know, whether this is gonna happen, right? Or this is gonna happen as we sit here today, whether we've made the lows or there are new lows, it's really gonna come around to whether or not we get this recession where, again, the uncertainty right now is just incredibly high. I don't think we've seen a big impact on the actual policies or even potential policies that were being talked about earlier this year. We probably won't begin to see that until the May data, which is released in June. So just adding to that survey, the data that are coming out right now are probably not fully reflective of what's going on in the economy. So again, the key question is around recession. Now, what we can do to attempt to get this answer, and again, this is a third-party chart, but I think rather instructive, you know, we're monitoring previous Fed rate cutting cycles, how the market is unfolding relative to that. So what this is showing essentially is dotted line shows where the market was essentially when the Fed began to cut rates. The orange line's the current period. And then you have this darker line, the average outcome when we haven't had a recession, vice versa for gray, and then the average of the two. And I'm less concerned about the average, but just the relative tracking to the good outcome and the bad outcome. You see the current market was pretty much tracking on top of the average, not followed by a recession. So the market, whether it got ahead of itself or not, was largely thinking that things were going to continue rather smoothly here and that Fed was largely cutting because inflation had decelerated and not necessarily for economic growth concerns. But then with the announcements and tariffs coming out, all of a sudden the flip or the switch essentially flipped to tracking the better outcome to tracking the bad outcome. And now we're essentially kind of in no man's land. So, you know, we have been tracking this, thinking that it was going to lead to a better outcome just based on history and how the market was unfolding. And then things obviously turned for worse, given what happened April 2nd subsequent to that. And again, now we're kind of in no man's land. So the market isn't necessarily tipping its hand very much as we sit here this morning. And when we think about, you know, if we do follow this outcome and the probabilities are not greater than 50%, but they're clearly not zero, you know, what could we potentially be looking at here? And if we go back to bear markets, you know, over the past 50 some odd years and just look at the last 11, again, this isn't a prediction, but we have to consider the possibility that this could happen in our decision-making process. You know, number one, did a recession occur? Did it not occur? Because there are some key differentiators there, but just the duration of the drawdown and the magnitude of it, you know, it's material. You know, averages around a year, about a third of a drawdown. So again, not a prediction, but we need to be mindful of this possibility and incorporating it into our decision-making process. Because again, if this unfolds, if we get that recession, things we have to think about is what is the impact to corporate earnings, number one, and number two, what's the impact on the price investors are willing to pay for those earnings? So we think about the former, earnings expectations, and I'll explain this chart, they have been revised down a little bit. So what we're showing here, the bars themselves, as evidenced by the legend, are the estimated, and for 2024, it's the actual, you know, growth rates of earnings, so the left-hand scale, and then the dot and triangle are the actual level of the dollars, right? The earnings per share themselves on the right-hand scale. So I'm more concerned about the growth rates themselves. So what we have seen, and this again played a part in some of the drawdown we saw in equities, the key concern being that fundamentals would disappoint, right? So in other words, we came into Q2 expecting about, we'll just call it 11 to 12% earnings growth for this calendar year. And as of 5.2, it was revised down to below 10. And then estimates for 2026 also came down as well, right? So again, if earnings themselves aren't as good as previously expected, that could have a marginally negative impact. But more importantly, from our perspective, and this feeds more into the outlook itself, is the price investors are willing to pay for those earnings. And so what do I mean by that? Essentially, the price to earnings ratio on a forward basis. So in other words, what's the price of the market today relative to what analysts expect earnings to be over the next 12 months? So if earnings themselves aren't as good as expected, that could impact the market on a marginally negative basis. But then what we typically see amongst recessionary periods is that the price investors are going to pay for those earnings, right? Or the valuation multiple tends to contract. And it remains, despite the recent drawdown, you know, somewhat elevated. So if we look at this darker line, this is the forward price to earnings ratio going back some 20 years. Where the purple line is just the average over this period, the green line, or I guess that's yellow, is over the past 10 years, and we're looking at that because valuations have been a little elevated compared to what they were over the full period. But we ended last Friday at 20.8. We ended a couple days ago at 21.6. just given a rally. And we came into the year at 21.9 around here. Okay, so when we think about these dynamics, valuations are a horrible short-term time. But we like to think of that more as, say, the potential for susceptibility to growth. So from an expectations perspective, so the higher the valuations relative to their own respective histories, the more susceptible things could be if the the data and the news flow don't meet those elevated expectations. So some of that played out, right? In 2022, we had these elevated valuations, and that largely the decline in the multiple is what drove those negative returns in 22. It wasn't necessarily that earnings deteriorated meaningfully. It was the price investors were willing to pay for those earnings came down a lot because of the uncertainty, because of the increasing odds of a recession. As those odds receded, you could see investors push back this multiple up essentially to where it was. So this played into some degree, as I talked about earlier, our decision to trim things in February. You know, if we were trading at average valuations, probably would have not made that decision. But given markets were relatively elevated in the U.S., again, we think it increases the potential for susceptibility, as I put it. In other words, the bar is high for news flow and data to clear, and things are optimistic. And if the news flow and data come in below those elevated expectations, then things can be a little bit more susceptible relative to where they otherwise would have been if we were trading more reasonably. So, this is a level of concern for us. Again, these things can stay elevated for a period. You can see up here for 2 years or so, but we'd be a heck of a lot more comfortable if things were trading more cheaply, because it's essentially a sign of more reasonable expectations moving forward. Now, to wrap things up on the next few slides, I talked about earlier, the U.S., obviously, economic growth estimates revised downward. That's what these bars are, essentially, for the IMF change in growth estimates for all these respective major countries and regions from their estimate in January this year versus their recent one in April. So they do it every quarter. And the change in those estimates for 25 and then 26. So big hit to the U.S. Again, they did these estimates today. Probably wouldn't be as dramatic given what's happened over the past couple weeks. Big hit to China. Really big, decent hit everywhere, right? So nobody was going to be relatively immune to this. But that said, when we think about outside the U.S., it was relatively, better than the U.S. itself, right? So you think about from an expectations perspective, the change in expectations outside the U.S. wasn't as bad in the U.S., so that was probably helpful for non-U.S. equities to do a little bit better, coupled with the fact that if we look at the same valuation framework as we did in the U.S. a second ago, they're trading much more cheaply, kind of in line with their respective averages, right? So again, if you think about it more from a susceptibility perspective, this is probably at least one of the reasons that they didn't underperform, right? We weren't overvalued in developed non-U.S. or in emerging markets. So as we think about things moving forward here from an equity perspective, the market hasn't really tipped its hand as to how it expects things to play out. Again, we're kind of in that no man's land based on the historical episodes. Equities within the U.S. a little bit elevated from a valuation perspective. Outside the U.S. is a little bit better. So to the extent we do get a poor outcome, what was interesting about Q1 was that relative performance where non-U.S. and EM did a little bit better, which is kind of an aberration based on the historical record. But we think these valuations likely explained it in part, and again, due to the fact that expectations were more muted for non-U.S. relative to the U.S. So we may actually see that continue if the market has a downdraft here later this year. And as far as the potential outcomes and what it means for what we're doing, as the market has continued to grind higher here, if it continues to do so over the next few weeks, we're not going to be anywhere near that sort of forced rebalance area that I spoke to earlier, that systematic piece, but we're likely to, take a more disciplined approach and rebalance if the market continues to grind higher because of those elevated valuations have come back into play. And if we do have a sort of relative over and underweights within the equity bucket, we're more likely to express that being overweight to non-U.S. equities relative to the U.S., given the valuation framework I spoke to, and given that the dollar itself remains a little bit overvalued, which, if it weakens, would be helpful for non-U.S. markets relative to the U.S. And then then finally, from a fixed income perspective, as we hit the hour mark, and I appreciate your time this morning. I don't love this chart. Our research team lost it, so let me try to explain it here. Yields, as I mentioned earlier, fell a little bit in Q1, so it was helpful for fixed income. They did so in April again, but in May, they backed up a little bit. So this is essentially the yield on investment-grade fixed income now, around 4.5%. And then this is essentially a scenario analysis, right? So based on what treasury yields do, if they increase, that would be negative for fixed income and vice versa. It spreads if they decrease or increase. Also impacting the one-year forward return. But the key point here is yields, you know, not massively elevated, but decent, certainly relative to the past 4 or 5 years or so. So despite what goes on in yields and spreads, there's a lot more green on this page than red. So in other words, as we look at a year, there'd have to be a pretty poor environment where yields are jumping and spreads are increasing for fixed income to post a negative return. So we do think it's going to continue to be that ballast in the portfolio that we saw in Q1, be that diversifier. So as we think about potentially rebalancing from equities, go back into fixed income or potentially cash once we do this fiscal year's reimbursement. Obviously, then we're thinking about the next year. We won't do all million or whatever, 2 million in pension at one time, but kind of incrementally add to that cash bucket when times are good, so that we don't become forced sellers in the event that things turn bad. So with all that said, I will pause there. Again, as always, happy to answer any questions or address comments, and again, appreciate you giving me a little extra time this morning to walk through some of these pages.
Thank you, Mr. Wing. Does any of the committee members have any questions or comments? Not hearing any. Thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Okay. Is there any additional business? I have one. I do want to welcome Mr. George Spindell today. We are very lucky to have him and his expertise on the committee. So thank you. Anything else from the committee? Thank you. All right. Hearing none, can I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion made.